Welcome to MoneyWeb at Midday, the actuality news show, offering unique insights and in-depth analysis featuring South Africa's top business leaders, newsmakers, and analysts for today's professionals. Your host, Jeremy Mads.
Hello and welcome to MoneyWeb at Midday. In the next 30 minutes, we'll go beyond the headlines with insight and analysis from leaders and decision makers shaping the future. So whether you're tuning in live or catching up later, stay ahead with just some of the stories that really matter. Coming up on the program, the death of Pope Francis, what happens next, preventing the next mining disaster in South Africa. South Africans are becoming more credit savvy, and new research shows student financial aid programs are now helping find jobs in high demand sectors. It's Tuesday, the 22nd of April. Today, the world continues to mourn the passing of Pope Francis, a pontiff who challenged orthodoxy, championed social justice, but also sparked some controversy within the wider Catholic Church. But as Vatican protocols now kick in, the question is, what legacy does he leave behind and where to from here for the global church? My guest is Father Russell Pollitt, a parish priest at the Holy Trinity Catholic Church. Russell, a very warm welcome to you and thank you for joining me. The legacy, first of all, of Pope Francis, and maybe with some reference to African Catholics, what would your assessment be?
Good afternoon, Jeremy, and thank you very much. I think that, first of all, he will certainly appeal to Africa because of the migration issues. And this was really a central theme of his pontificate, that he was very concerned about migrants and refugees. And one of the first things he did when he was made Pope was to go to Lampedusa to drop into the water a reef there to remember African migrants who had drowned in the Mediterranean. And so I think that would resonate because we know there's a lot of movement on our continent that is driven by economics, that is driven by war, and driven by climate change. And I think that would be another thing for many people in this part of the world, the question of, droughts, flooding. He had a lot to say about that. And I certainly think that would resonate with people on this continent, especially African Catholics.
Russell, how effective was he in balancing tradition with the need for modernization within the Catholic Church's practices and teachings?
Yeah, he walked a tightrope, I think. So, you know, many people would say he tried to throw tradition out the window. I don't think that's true. I think what he did was he saw tradition as something which was important, but on its own, it was not really speaking into the lives of people. And what he tried to do was bring the tradition into the life of people through some of the things that he did. For example, inclusion was a massive theme as well of this pontificate. You know, people, LGBTI people who were excluded, or, elderly people that are often pushed to the peripheries, divorced people. The Pope really tried to say, okay, the church has got certain teachings about these things, but how do we practically live them out? Through the lens of compassion, through the lens of mercy and inclusion. And I think that's the way that he saw tradition, as tradition is not something that a law out there somewhere, but tradition is something that's lived in the lives of people. And the tradition must almost, if one could say it like this, it must almost be a living tradition by saying something to people, by giving them hope, especially maybe when they felt hopeless or down or had given up.
Let me push you a little bit on inclusivity, all well and good, but he did stop short of endorsing the ordination of women, did he not?
Oh, yes, he did. And this is some of the unfinished business. He set up commissions to study the ordination of women. I think for many women, there was great hope that there would be a diaconate that opens up to them. He didn't do that. He didn't go that far. What he did do was he gave some women, key positions in the Vatican that were always held before by men. So he changed the face of the offices of the Curia by putting women in charge of those offices. Those commissions on the study of women deacons are still an ongoing thing. And now that he's dead, we don't know what will happen to those commissions. For some women, he didn't go far enough. For other people, he may have gone a little bit too far by putting women in charge of things. But I think that is one of the big unfinished issues in this pontificate.
Another unfinished issue, perhaps, is his efforts to address clerical sexual abuse. Did he go far enough, or did he fall short in delivering real justice to victims?
You know, it depends who you speak to, Jeremy. I think for many victims feel that he didn't go far enough, that there wasn't enough emphasis given to reconciliation and to justice for victims. The Pope himself was one of the first popes to meet with victims, to address it, and he met with victims over and over and over in different parts of the world. He was also one of the first popes to fire, and even defrock some clergy, some high-ranking officials who were involved or knew about clergy sex abuse and did nothing about that. So I think it's a mixed bag. I think on one hand, he did go further than what his predecessors went. But if he went far enough is a big question. And also, there are still some scandals which he didn't seem to deal with. The very famous one is Father Marco Rupnik, and he still continues, it seems, to practice as a priest. There's serious allegations against him. So a mixed bag, and I don't think he quite got that right. He did push out on that. It was one of the things I think that the cardinals asked him to look at when he first took over as Pope, but I think he found that quite difficult to deal with, and I think a lot more work still needs to be done in the church about addressing the question of justice for victims.
And Russell, looking ahead now, his papacy, is it going to widely influence the selection and even the direction of his successor? Might we see a more conservative rollback in the next person to come?
We might, you know, and I mean, the church itself is divided on this. I mean, I think those who are more progressive would hope for somebody who is like him, progressive, or maybe even more progressive. I think the more conservative side of the church is hoping that there will be a pulling in now, so to speak, and that somebody more conservative will be appointed. I think it's really difficult to tell for two reasons. The first one is this Pope appointed cardinals from parts of the world that never had cardinals before. You would have expected the Archbishop of Los Angeles to be a cardinal, or Philadelphia. He never did that. He chose way out little places of people we've never heard of before. And so the cardinals themselves don't know each other, because some of those cardinals even live in places where media is not like we have in this country or in some of the first world countries. So the getting to know of these people, getting to know each other before they sit down to elect someone, will be really important. And somebody may emerge from the peripheries that nobody really knows about. He's put a real gamble in it, I think, by the people that he chose as cardinals. The second thing is, I think that he has shown a very human side of the papacy. He perhaps has brought the papacy into the lives of ordinary people just by his gestures. And I think whoever is elected next will be thinking about this. You know, how do I maintain that human side of the papacy, yet also address the issues which I think are important, which may not necessarily be the issues that Francis has thought important. He certainly didn't address the issues that Benedict had. Benedict was really worried about the reconversion of the West and the fall of Christianity in the West. Pope Francis was much more concerned about social justice and migrants and things like that. So whoever comes next will also have his own issues to address. But I think the question of being a human being and living the papacy in a different way will be something that whoever comes will have to think of very carefully.
Just a quick answer. Could we see a pope emerge from Africa?
We could. There are some candidates that we've even got our own archbishop here in Johannesburg, Cardinal Brislin, who will be there, who will be voting. People are speaking about Cardinal Robert Sarah, Cardinal Nixon. Those are all Africans. It's possible.
Russell Pollitt, thank you very much indeed, parish priest at the Holy Trinity Catholic Church. I appreciate your time today.
You're listening to MoneyWeb at Midday.
Now, we are acknowledging something called Earth Day today, and obviously there is a call for cleaner energy. And maybe this is an opportune moment for us to talk about the dirtier side of mining. And behind the push for critical minerals the world over lies a growing threat, something called toxic tailings dam failures. And I want to speak to someone now who has been sounding the alarm in this particular respect, but not only the alarm, but let's also look at potential solutions here. I'm talking to Alistair Bovum, who's Chief Executive Officer of Insight Terra, a climate technology firm. Alistair, welcome. Thank you very much indeed. Let's talk about these tailings dams, for instance. They are failing more frequently, you're going to tell us. What are they and what's the problem here?
Thanks, Jeremy. Yes, actually, there's been five failures in this year already, which is quite alarming. And effectively, tailings dams are dams where the waste from the mining process is stored. And I think one thing for people to understand is they're constantly growing, right? They're constantly being constructed, and the walls raised, so it's a growing dam. And they are active for the life of the mine and for decades after the mine is closed. So there's both a responsibility to manage them really carefully while they're being constructed and operated, and then once the mine is closed and through the mine closure process.
So where is the failure happening then?
Well, there are a couple of challenges, right? So climate change and increased rainfall is one particular threat to tailings dams. One of the biggest threats is water, and especially when there's change in weather patterns and more increased rainfall, that has changed the threat level effectively. The other is there are more and more tailings dams being constructed because of the demand for metals and minerals. We are seeing demand for things like copper driving more tailings dams, and commodities like copper actually produce a lot of tailings waste. So I think consumers need to realize that their mobile phones, their laptops, and their EV cars all come from a mine, and these need to be managed carefully.
Which I guess begs the question then about current risk monitoring systems, and are they working or simply just box-ticking exercises?
So the key is proactive risk management. I think with new risks and new heightened threats, there needs to be a proactive approach. And the old way of just doing a risk register and doing it every quarter or so is not going to work anymore. That's in whether you're in a business with all the uncertainties in the world at the moment, as well as when you're managing a tailings facility. There are tools and technology which can really augment and support the engineers to proactively manage these facilities.
So what does a more proactive approach actually mean, and at what cost?
So a proactive approach is supporting the type of work that already happens, which is assessments and testing, but also using technology like instrumentation, which allows you to monitor the health of the tailings facility, what's happening underground and in the embankment in more real time, supporting engineers to make more proactive decisions. And Jeremy, these things fail slowly, but when they fail fast. So a lot of the trends are minute, where you might be looking at millimeter acceleration over a year. So often this is very hard for a human to detect in a spreadsheet. But using technology, machine learning, you can actually drive more statistical analysis in real time, giving the engineers information to assess and respond proactively.
What about chief executives or those who run mines? Do you think, as a result of what you've just outlined to me, they maybe underestimate the financial and, I guess, reputational risk of the problem?
I think tailings is one of the top risks that keeps CEOs and mining companies awake at night. I think that's been reflected on recent reports. But I do think it's a culture that has to be top-down and a bottom-up. We still see we have to do a lot of education in the mining companies and on the engineers on site and the managers on site. So there's a culture of safety and risk management that has to be continually supported throughout the life cycle. It's not just a once-off approach. It has to be a continuous program.
And I would imagine this is a bigger issue when it comes to maybe second-tier smaller mines, where they are always more margin-pressed and cash is always an issue.
I think one of the good things about the global industry standard, which came out in 2020 and is now being adopted by a lot of the small and junior miners, is actually there's a framework that they can adopt. It's called GISTM, or the Global Industry Standard on Tailings Management. 177 requirements and protocols and lots of literature where people can adopt that. It really fast tracks their approach to proactive risk management. So there's actually shouldn't be an excuse for the smaller and junior operators. There are actually tools and methods and systems out there to support them in this process.
All well and good if we have those global standards, but the question, I guess, is are South African mines complying sufficiently in that respect?
I think, from my opinion, South African mines are actually leaders in this space. We've have some of the top engineers in the world that and our knowledge and experience has been spreading globally. And I think that's one of the reasons the Global Tailings Institute is being established in South Africa. But we need to ensure that all mines across Africa are taking a proactive approach. So I think South Africa has a leading role to be a thought leader in this place, in the space, and take this forward into global spheres.
Alistair, I absolutely understand the importance of technology as far as this is concerned, and obviously that would be your area of expertise. But I'm also assuming that the role of communities within the mining orbit is just as important when it comes to oversight and early warning.
Indeed, Jeremy, communities have to be involved in emergency response planning. Those plans need to be tested. Communities need to be involved in establishing them and making sure that it works, right? There's no point having an alarm going off and nobody's trained to react. So it's definitely very important that communities are involved up front and not just as a reaction to it. And I think there's an opportunity for communities to really be part of the process.
I'm going to leave it there. Alistair Bovem, thank you very much indeed. Chief Executive Officer of Insight Terra. I appreciate your time.
MoneyWeb at midday for all your up-to-date stories.
Now, more and more South Africans are checking their credit scores and are fighting back against fraud. And that's good news. But here's my question. Is this a financial awakening? This financial awakening, is it widespread or is it superficial? And how can we build on it? I want to give you a perspective now from Fakhi Adams, who is head of credit risk solutions at TransUnion Africa. It's the big information technology company. Fakhi, welcome. Thank you very much indeed. So what are the key shifts then that you've seen in South Africans' credit behavior in the first quarter of this year?
Yeah, so our latest Consumer Pulse survey shows that there's a greater awareness of your credit and your credit report and managing your credit better. What we've observed is that more and more consumers are actively checking their credit reports. And this is obviously a good thing. Once people start checking their credit reports regularly, they have greater awareness of the existing situation, as well as exposure to any type of potential fraud. And catching this quite early does help them further down the line. So it's definitely a move in the right direction. And it's something that we're obviously trying to promote more and more. As you know, TransUnion is very deliberate in our intention to solve for financial inclusion. And by developing the tools and products required to solve for financial inclusion and bring more people into the formal credit economy, it wouldn't be responsible of us to do that without also giving them the tools to manage this credit responsibly.
What do you think is driving this heightened awareness?
Well, I think, as you're aware, fraud is a big thing. Right, the fraudsters work as hard, if not harder than we do, to try and get access to people's money. So that more and more people are becoming aware of the threat of fraud, the more people are looking for ways to manage fraud and be ahead of the fraudsters. So that's one of the major components. Another factor as well is people taking control of their financial future. We find that at least one in three people are now checking the reports monthly with the intent of improving their credit score, which, as you know, is the key to a fit financial future.
So one in three or a third of people checking their credit reports monthly, I guess that's a good sign, but still far too little.
Yeah, there's still a lot of work to be done. I mean, one in three is a good number, and this number is increasing. But the more financial awareness we can create, the better economy will grow, right? By showing people that there are tools in place to help them manage their finances better, it sets them up for a fit financial future.
Do you think that people actually understand what affects their credit score?
And that's part of the financial literacy and financial awareness that we're trying to drive. So there's multiple factors that influence your financial standing and your credit score. And we're trying to ensure that more consumers are aware of what they need to consider and how to manage their finances better so that they are able to have a good credit future. So things like ensuring you're paying all of your accounts on time, ensuring that you don't overutilize the credit that you do have at your disposal, and also ensuring that you don't make too many credit applications in a short period of time. These are just a few things that consumers need to be wary of, and things that when you're reading your credit report, things that you need to look out for and manage correctly.
So make the link then. How should people use the credit reports to protect themselves better from scams? Connect the dots for me.
So once you start looking at your credit report more often, you should look out for things like loans or credit that you're not aware of. If you hadn't applied for a loan and there's a loan showing on your report, that's a red flag automatically. Another thing you should look out for is applications that are being made against your name. So whenever you do an application for any form of credit product, the lender needs to ping the bureau to have a view of what your credit worthiness looks like. So if you're seeing multiple inquiries against your name by multiple lenders, that again is a red flag if you haven't originated those inquiries against your name.
Do you think that more transparency in credit pricing would help curb abuse?
I definitely think so. I mean, lots of people are in the market for credit, and sometimes you're in a desperate situation where you're taking out the credit regardless of the cost. But it's the responsibility of the lender to be completely transparent with the applicants, so they understand what they're getting themselves into, especially with the current state of the economy and the uncertainty in terms of interest, VAT, and all these other fees. You need to be transparent to the applicant so that they know what they're getting themselves into, because if situations change further down the line, both in your personal perspective as well as in the market, you need to ensure that you're still able to pay your obligations and your commitments that you've made.
And that's part of the problem in many ways, that the banks or the lenders are not doing enough to educate and empower their borrowers. There is a sense that people will know this stuff anyway.
100%. And that's why credit education and financial literacy is critical. And to my previous point, giving the consumers the tools to get access to the credit is only one part of it. Ensuring that they know what to look out for when they commit themselves to the credit is a completely different story, and it's almost a bigger component than giving them the access, is educating them around how to manage and what to look out for.
But apart from just being poorly informed in many respects, the other big issue, of course, is that South Africans are just simply too overborrowed, aren't they?
So Africans are extremely overborrowed, but I think they've learned quite a bit. And we do see there's a lot of cautious optimism in the market. So people are becoming more financially aware, and we see that coming through. I mean, 1 in 3 people checking their credit reports means that we are more financially savvy. So we will hopefully see this improving over time as more people start managing themselves and getting a hold on their financial situation.
So just a final one then, Fathi, are there practical steps in your opinion that every consumer should be taking from the get-go to build a better credit record?
Yeah, definitely. I think the first step towards that is regularly checking your credit report, even if it just means every month going in there, assigning 10 to 15 minutes just to go through your credit report to ensure that everything on there is what you are aware of and everything that you have initiated yourselves. And also ensuring that you are paying your obligations on time, making sure you're paying those installments, as well as not overutilizing the credit that you do have access to. These steps will ensure that you set yourself up for a fit financial future.
And the consequences are very negative if you don't do that.
100%. Like I said, financial inclusion is a big theme for TransUnion. By not paying your debt, right, and giving people access to credit and not educating them about the importance of paying it, they might find themselves in a situation further down the line where these early defaults now restrict them from getting finances in the future.
And that's something that people do not want to come back and bite them. Fathi Adams, thank you very much indeed. Some very useful advice there, head of Credit Risk Solutions, TransUnion Africa. I appreciate the time.
You're listening to MoneyWeb at Midday.
A new alumni survey from the IKUSASA Student Financial Aid Program is showing signs of progress, but also some persistent red flags. Take a listen to these percentages. 67% of funded graduates are employed or in earned internships, and nearly one in five pursuing further studies, but 13% remain unemployed. Many say they are battling in a saturated job market. There's also the whole issue of a lack of experience, plus limited access to real opportunities, in spite of the fact that they do hold qualifications. Now, the program was set up to fund, support, and future-proof young South Africans from disadvantaged backgrounds. So what's working and what is falling short? I'm joined by the Chief Executive Officer, Vern Abrahams. A very warm welcome to you, and thanks for talking to us. That 13% unemployment rate, is that within the kind of acceptable margins of your model?
Yes, it is. Specifically, actually, if you look at the reasons for that 13% unemployment rate, the majority of the reasons are also students who wish to pursue their postgraduate studies for a formal qualification, that being either actuarial qualification or a chartered accountant qualification, and actually obtaining that funding for that postgraduate degree. That seems to be the big problem. So at ISFAP, we are also trying to expand the scope of our model to actually address those concerns by providing funding for more postgraduate students as well.
This next question is not just directed at your program, but I think it's more broad. Many graduates are still struggling with basic access to jobs. So I guess the question is the market simply too saturated, or are students not being properly job matched?
I think it is the former, with the market being saturated. So if you just have a general, for instance, BCom degree, you are going to find it difficult to find formal employment. I think the market is so saturated at the moment where it does require a kind of a formal accredited qualification to enhance your chances of employment.
So how do you move beyond the example of the BCom then? What do students need to do in that respect?
Generally, I think also other factor is the geographical location as to where the jobs are. So for instance, if you do have a kind of a general qualification, you would maybe find it difficult to find the job in the Western Cape, whereas in Gauteng, where there's probably more administrative jobs available at head office companies for students to kind of then go into those provinces to find employment. Because what we're also finding with our alumni survey is that actually the 59% of our students actually found employment within Gauteng, with another 11% in Limpopo and only 7% in the Western Cape. So that geographical location also seems to be a kind of a stumbling block.
And Werner, that's both an opportunity and a problem, I would imagine. So 59% of jobs concentrated in Gauteng, I mean, that does make sense economically. But I guess that students need to then be prepared to move. The problem is not many people are necessarily wanting to do that.
Correct, yes. Specifically with regards to obviously the difference in service delivery within provinces itself. So obviously if you could find a remote kind of position for maybe a head office company in Gauteng and working from the Western Cape, that is an option, but those type of positions are few and far between. So it is a stumbling block for students at the moment, I agree.
Your survey also talks about the domination of contract work. I absolutely understand that, but there is a risk in graduates being locked out of stable and more permanent roles. But I guess in many respects, that's also the way of the modern economy, isn't it?
Correct, yes. I think employers also prefer, obviously, the contract model at first to see, obviously, how the new graduates progress through that first or second year after graduating. And from there, obviously, more permanent positions could emanate. But it's also then for the graduates in that specific contract time, obviously, to kind of prove themselves and utilize their skills, not only from the university itself, but also from our program where we do provide holistic support to those type of students.
Often, though, if you're working on a contract, the organization organization will use you for the duration of the contract and then get rid of you because it's expedient, it's easy to do, and they'll simply find someone else to fill the contract, and you'll find yourself out on the street again. That really is a problem, but I guess, again, it's the risk of the economic environment within which we operate.
Yes, fully agree that it is a problem, but it also provides actually the student with an opportunity to gain that work experience, which is then maybe required for another position somewhere else. So I think for students also is for them to utilize first or second year of the contract to also then get that 2-3 year experience to put on their CVs and find employment from there.
And Vernon, just a final question. Your survey also points to 66% of graduates say their job fully aligns with their qualification. In other words, there's a vast percentage that are perhaps studying the wrong thing or are being placed badly. That's not good enough. How do you get that equation more equitable?
Yes, I think with the 66%, there's another, 15% that is highly related to the actual job that they studied for. But I think with graduates also, once an employment offer is made for students never having received the salary before, the salary plus the job experience, I think students kind of are not choosing in terms of what it is they do, but just gaining that experience and gaining that salary to get into the kind of employment. But yes, I think what can be done better in that sense is just also from our model is to work more closely, obviously, with the corporates. We are looking at actually developing a formal portal as well, where these kind of employers could then come onto our portal and see what type of students are available for employment, etc. So I think it is an evolving thing where between ourselves plus our employers, we could work more closely together for more fully related jobs for graduates.
Well, you've certainly shone a light on the changing face of work. Thank you very much indeed. That's Vernon Abrams, Chief Executive Officer of the Ikwesasa Student Financial Aid Program. I do appreciate your time. Thank you. And that is our program for today. We're back tomorrow, live at noon, then up as a podcast. Goodbye to you. Thank you for listening.
Listen to the daily live stream of MoneyWeb at midday or download episodes on moneyweb.co.za, the MoneyWeb app, Apple Podcasts and Spotify, or follow MoneyWeb News on social media for more updates. MoneyWeb, your trusted source for business and investment insights.